We learn about the 3000 Black Business Challenge here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So it's an initiative launched by the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce focused on starting up thousands of Black-owned businesses in the Milwaukee area by 2024. The Chamber is among two dozen organizations to get funding through the state's Diverse Business Assistance Grant program recently to help push toward this goal. Are you a Black business owner? How did you get your start? What advice do you have for others following in your footsteps? 800-642-1234. Reuben Hopkins is founder, chairman, and CEO of the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce. Reuben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Why 3,000? Why this number?
Well, you know, in actuality, it should be 3,000 a year, right? Mm. So the Black business community, we are really and actually generations behind when it comes to entrepreneurs. We traditionally work for someone else. And so if you look at most Black businesses, you'll find their first, second generation at the most. And we have very few 3, 4, 5 generation owned businesses because it's just not in our historical DNA in this country to be business owners.
And that certainly is reflective of Milwaukee having one of the lowest ratios of Black-owned businesses in the country. That was a study by LendingTree. What obstacles do you see out there for Black entrepreneurs?
Well, it's like, I think it's like anything. You know, the biggest obstacle historically has been racism, mm-hmm. you know, and the control of resources. And so in order to stay in power, you have to control the resources. And so, and then you have, you know, just the societal challenge of, you know, capitalist society needs consumers, right? And so to have a group of people who do nothing but consume actually benefits the society. So on one level, there's that, you know, just go to work, you know, get paid and spend, you know. And so business ownership, we definitely have some challenges.
What have been some of the challenges that you've seen for Black-owned businesses in these times, in the pandemic, in COVID?
Well, you know, it's, you know, I think we've gotten used to being left out or just sitting on the sidelines hoping that, you know, they put us in the game, you know, kind of thing. Mm. And so I remind people all the time that we have a very, let me see how to put it. It's sort of along the lines of the Urban League report that says there's pent-up energy in the Black community. Mm-hmm. And it's pent-up in Black communities all around this country, right? Mm-hmm. We're all locked into the lowest level of a real-life monopoly game. And we're trying to play the game without the resource. And so that's the biggest challenge in the Black community is we're undercapitalized. The banks in the Black community are undercapitalized. The businesses are undercapitalized. And in many central cities around the country, most of the entertainment venues are outside of the Black community. So all of that money leaves out the community every weekend because even if we don't have those venues, we will still find them and enjoy ourselves. And so the biggest challenge is just the social construct that central cities have become. And rather than investing in them, people have chose to avoid them.
We're talking with Reuben Hopkins, who's founder, CEO of the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce, as we discuss the work to help thousands of new Black-owned businesses get off the ground in coming years and the obstacles, the barriers, historical barriers in the way. You can join in. Are you a business owner, a person of color? How did you get started? What advice do you have for others creating new businesses? 800-642-1234. So Ruben, as part of this effort to develop, create more Black-owned businesses, the Chamber is starting this boot camp perspective. Can you explain what these boot camps will do?
Well, yeah. So our first challenge is to get everybody on the same page. And so normally what happens is, you know, it's almost like a town hall environment where you don't know who's going to show up. When we have these like business meetings and because you don't know who's going to show up. And generally what happens is there's always somebody in the wrong meeting, you know, and we have, so what we want to do is create an environment where we get the right people in the right meeting, in the right industries, being able to understand what people are talking about. For example, we have businesses who are not interested in doing business with the government. They just want to grow as businesses. So they don't really, they're trying to understand certifications at the city, county, and state level that they think they need. And we try to explain to them, if you don't want to do business with the government, a certification is not required.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it can sometimes benefit you if contractors are looking to fill requirements that a contract they may have received has on it. So if the contract says, hey, you need 30% minority participation on this contract, if you are certified, it's easier for them to find you
mm-hmm.
than if you're not certified, right? And so, but then the stigma that sometimes comes with certification means that it's almost like a set-aside or affirmative action, and people begin to use that against you rather than understand the historical, the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sometimes amazed that, you know, everybody, you know, everybody at some point wants to ignore the history of this country, and it's just, it can slow the process down.
I want to ask you about those contracts, about the Wisconsin Supplier Diversity Program and these efforts to get minority-owned businesses a more level playing field to win more state contracts, and Wisconsin having that goal of 5% of its contracts supplied by minority-owned businesses. How effective do you think is the state at connecting minority-owned businesses and landing these bids? What is it like?
Well, it's right now it's kind of it's just a concept. The 5% minority participation goal is the minority community makes up 20% of the state population, right? But so all of us, the Chinese, the Hispanics, the Asians, the American Indians, all of the different ethnic and diverse chambers and groups that are out there, we make up about 20% of the Wisconsin population. But the participation goal when it comes to doing business with, and it's not even really a goal, it's a suggestion. The participation suggestion is that we try to meet a 5% contracting goal with, you know, minority businesses. But that goal extends beyond the state of Wisconsin. So sometimes even when you look at the numbers that Wisconsin does, some of those minority contractors that were used are not even in Wisconsin.
Hmm.
And so all of us, all 20% of us have to find a way to get part of that 5% that state government might spend with us, right? And so that's one of the challenges as well, is how do we know when the state is making progress on its minority contracting? And so, you know, we've suggested some changes even to Marketplace, the Governor's Conference on Minority Business, because at that event every year, we highlight minority businesses. But again, the participation goal and the amount of contracting that's actually being done with minority businesses is never talked about. And so we're like, okay, so what's the point of marketplace if we're not, it's not going to show progress every year that we're moving towards the equity and inclusion that everybody's talking about right now?
Let's pause right there with Reuben Hopkins, leads the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce, as we learn about this initiative to grow 3,000 Black-owned businesses by 2024. What effects on the community have you seen when people of color are able to start and grow businesses? Where are the gaps? Where are the gaps in resources for these new ventures? What challenges did you encounter? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Reuben Hopkins here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring how the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce is using grants from the state as seed money to help startups get established. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. LinkedIn shared new data on the business challenges of Black women entrepreneurs, finding through its surveys that more Black women professionals than ever have launched ventures in these pandemic times. But access to startup funding is a big obstacle. Its surveys found less than 1 in 5 Black women business owners had received funding. Can you identify? Are you a minority-owned business? What barriers did you face when securing capital and credit? Join in 800-642-1234. Reuben Hopkins is CEO of the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce with us for about 9 more minutes. Reuben, you know, I talked there about Black women entrepreneurs, and I'm wondering, do you think there is some uniqueness, some differences in the steps to Black women professionals getting established? And what do you see there?
Well, it's a couple of things. They're the most educated group of African Americans in the country. And so that's one of the things. But, you know, you have to have markets. You know, and when you don't have a market and you're trying to grow a business, and but your market is driving out of your neighborhood into other neighborhoods in order to spend their money, it makes it very difficult for anyone who's starting a business to hang out a shingle and say, hey, come and buy my product or service. Mm-hmm. And so a big part of it is redeveloping markets and re-identifying, you know, how to access those markets. And so, you know, we often talk about, you know, people always want to talk about, you know, the entitlement community that, you know, the Black community is made up of. But again, most of the money that comes in the form of entitlement leaves because the money, so yeah, you might get energy assistance, but the money doesn't go to you. The money that goes to We Energies, mm-hmm. right? You might get a food share, but again, you get to eat and you get to feed your family again, but the money goes to pick and save and roundies, right? And so that's where so it's just filtering through the community, going out to other business organizations. Then when you look at all the entertainment dollar that leaves our community every weekend, everything from bowling to the movies to, you know, to decent restaurants, they're all outside of the Black community. So all of that money is being spent outside of the Black community. So if you effectively just divested in really investing in, you know, an economy that can function independent of, independently in a community, then that community is going to depend on certain ways of surviving. And so trying to start a business, you know, in an environment where you don't have markets that are ready for you or available to you, that's the challenge that we're running into. And that's one of the things that we want to change with this challenge, because the challenge is, again, we're going to deal with startups, but we're also going to deal with technical assistance to existing businesses, as well as capacity building for those businesses that want to expand capacity. All of these things are possible. They're all, positive.
And meeting businesses where they're at, in the challenges where they are, in particular with that business, it sounds like, really, really focused on where they're at.
Yeah, and so the boot camp is designed for us to go through people understanding some basic things. For example, Section 3 businesses. Are you in a census tract that is an SBA hub zone? Is your business located in a census tract that is an SBA hub zone where you can register as a Section 3 business? And again, priority is set aside when it comes to government contracting. Again, all of it is designed to move businesses forward. But if the business doesn't even understand that they're in a SBA hub zone or that they're right next to an opportunity zone, economic development, then they tend not to do anything because I didn't even know I was in an SBA hub zone, right? Or I don't even know what a business improvement district is. I just wanted to start a business, right? I don't understand, this zoning thing and these occupancy permits and, why the person across the street doesn't have to do it, but we have to do it because they're in a different district, or that's the boundary line. And on that side of the street, the rules are different. And so learning and trying to understand all of this stuff is the challenge. And so through the boot camp, we take people through all of these different concepts so that they understand, so they have a better understanding of what people are talking about when you're hearing certain conversations. And you better understand where where the money is, right? So if we might do $1,000 scholarship or $1,000 grant to help you start up, but then what? How did you move from startup to being able to go to a bank and say, I need $120,000 to open this restaurant? What do your numbers look like? What do your finances look like? Who are your competition? Let us see your business plan. How's your personal credit, right? Have you established business credit? All of these things are things that sometimes people go into business not even aware of, and so that's the challenge that we've kind of taken on for the Central City of Milwaukee.
I want to pause right here and reintroduce you as we talk with Reuben Hopkins, CEO of the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce, discussing his chamber's work to help thousands of new Black-owned businesses get off the ground in coming years. Reuben, I do want to ask you this, that, starting a business, it could take 50, 60, 70, 80-hour work weeks. If you are a single parent, if you don't have access to the startup capital, what do you tell an entrepreneur to get their business established?
That's a hard one because, as a single parent, I've been in, my daughters went to meetings with me, and that's not always possible, when you have meetings and you have children, or you have a job, right, and children, and you at some point want to, break free or start, start anew. And in those cases, it is life. It's the luck of the draw, We can't transform everybody's life into situations where they'll endeavor to persevere, right? Mm-hmm. At some point, you just got to make decisions as to what you want to do and what sacrifices you are willing to make in order to do it. And I see it, but I also see when people are trying to do too much with too little, and that's also frustrating as well, because a lot of times people will come and say, hey, I only need $10,000 or I only need, $5,000, for this or for that. And the challenge is we're not a lender. And so we give guidance and we give direction and we can, here's the phone number who you need to talk to, but we're not a lender. But when you go to those lenders, if your finances are not in order, mm-hmm. then you run into that wall as well, where they're saying, "Nah, come back when your finances are in order." Because if you're going to borrow my money, I need to know how you're going to pay it back,
mm-hmm.
which is a fair question. I mean, which is fair. If you're going to borrow my money, I need to know how you're going to pay it back, which is what the banks and the credit unions and the CDFIs are asking. How stable are you?
Right.
And so the goal is to prepare people for that reality that, hey, you got to sit down. You got to make sure your numbers are straight. You got to make sure that what you're doing makes sense. You got to even know the industry that you're getting ready to go into and the shifts that are going on in that industry.
Well, Ruben, thank you for this conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Ruben Hopkins, founder, chairman, CEO of the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce, plans to help create 3,000 new Black-owned businesses in the state by 2024. Ahead this hour, we talk with a UW-Madison geneticist and artist who was one of 120 women scientists honored with a 3D-printed statue on the National Mall. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It went down in history as the largest collection of statues of women ever assembled together. The Smithsonian's effort to feature 120 contemporary women scientists during Women's History Month on the National Mall. We explore the life and work of one of those women in STEM, empowering innovation here in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW-Madison Professor Anna Scope is at the intersection of genetics and art, her lab focusing on mitosis, how cells divide, which she sees as absolute artistry. How does science and art come together for you? How do you create a STEM culture? How do you create a STEAM culture in education? 800-642-1234. Anna Scope, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
How did it feel for you to be one of these 120 American women scientists who had a statue there on the National Mall?
Well, it's quite intimidating and thrilling at the same time to be 3D printed and out there as a sculpture. But I'm quite honored, and it's been remarkable to meet so many amazing other women scientists doing unbelievably awesome stuff. So it has been very cool to be part of this program.
I would imagine you met women through this program that you had never known, women who had never been on your radar before.
Yeah, no, there's lots of women I've never met before. One of the coolest ones, I kind of had heard of her, but I met this one woman who actually has a galaxy named after her. So I thought that was kind of awesome. And, you know, there's very cool people that I met through this, and just people overcoming boundaries and changing the way and changing the view of science and that women can do just about everything and that they want.
What was that process of having your likeness created for the project? I mean, just a little bit of science-y here on this 3D printing. What did it entail?
It kind of looked like I walked into a booth. It kind of it's like a bigger suntan booth or something. and there were a lot of lights up around the edge. And they had actually almost like a Project Runway kind of salon next to this. It was kind of fun, different kind of thing that I normally experience. And then we had, you know, we had our hair and makeup done, and we went in this booth, and then a bunch of lights went off, and it scanned our body in three dimensions. And it was very intimidating because there's a lot, nothing is hidden in this capture of ourselves. And we didn't really see the three-dimensional thing until it was printed. You know, we saw the photos of how the process, but it was very cool. You know, walked into a booth within seconds, you know, and then outcomes after several months of printing all of these things, outcomes a sculpture. So that was kind of cool.
I'm going to pick up on that word intimidating, because for some students, some people, science and math are very intimidating. How do you approach that? How do you lessen that stress?
I think that a lot of students think that, there's all the classes that they took in high school, they realize they have to memorize everything and do all that stuff. But really, that's not what science is about. We're not we know things, but we're problem solvers, which is super fun. I mean, lots of doctors, any job that you have are problem solvers. And so what, you know, science can be intimidating because I think people think about all these other things and how those exams might have been to memorize things. But I think the way science is being taught now is changing because we're doing this project-based learning in the classroom. And I think that's where the fun is. And that's what I like about science, because I study how cells divide, which is important. You know, when it goes wrong, that's what happens in cancer. And so I want to figure that out and to be a problem solver. In that sense, it's fun. And I can come up with my new ideas and do that. And I think that's where, you know, science can be intimidating because you realize you have to understand the breadth of knowledge of science.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get down to it, you understand your problem and then you start to ask questions. And that's where it becomes fun. It can be intimidating because there's a lot of, you know, a lot of data and knowledge that you have to read up on. And I don't know everything either, but I'm able to ask questions and attempt to answer them in the laboratory.
And asking questions is a big part of how you teach, that participation, I understand, that group discussion, hugely important in your classes. And lecturing from the front of the class is much of lesser importance. Why is that?
I decided to flip the classroom because I realized one of my favorite courses in my own undergrad was a plant physiology class where the class, he barely lectured and we did the problem solve. So he gave us a problem, aphids bite plants, solve it in any way you could solve it. And I love that because that's how science actually is. And I realized when I became a faculty member, I wanted to kind of recreate that experience of, you know, I don't come to my laboratory and fill out a bubble sheet, right? Hmm. I come to ask questions and try to answer them doing genetics and cell biology. And so I wanted to kind of create that in the classroom so that students experience the fun and excitement that I do. And I do that by teaching them how to communicate science visually and orally and verbally. And so students realize I give them their own project to work on, and they have to kind of come up with an idea that could potentially be a grant proposal. And they actually love being able to get in there and realize, oh my gosh, there are a lot of scientists that are working haven't even asked that question that they're interested in. I said, well, that's why you belong in science, you know. And I think that's the excitement that I want students to come away from my class, to realize that science is fun and that everyone's diverse background is very important in answering questions and problems in science. And, you know, we all want to help people just like medical doctors do. We do this because we want to help, right? And understand things.
I'm going to just reintroduce you here, talking with Anna Scope, who's a UW-Madison geneticist and artist, explaining her approach to teaching in the classroom and promoting STEM. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Anna, another thing that I found really interesting about your approach to teaching is that how you assign grades. You give grades through this growth mindset approach. Can you explain how you, the system behind how you award letter grades?
Yeah, I realized that a lot of students, and particularly women underrepresented students, there's often anxiety in the classroom. And it dawned on me that, you know, in the end, grades don't matter. It's what you get out of that course. So why not flip this idea of, instead of students working up towards 100 points, and most people know how to do all the math about losing points out of 100, why not give them all the points on the first day and everyone gets an A, and the goal is to try to maintain all those points. But I give them about 800 points because I'm also dyslexic, so hard to do a quick math out of 800 points, is that you don't really know how many points that you've lost. And so I kind of do that. What happens is there are lots of students on the first day, is I've never felt more confident on a first day of class than I did in yours. And I think that's why I use this unique strategy, is I want them to feel welcome and having the ability to succeed. Right. Mm. The point is not to tear people down. It's to build people up. And I think that growth mindset theory that is based on helps students understand that their point of view and what they bring to the table is important. It also levels the playing field because a lot of students have biases about where they are in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Is students that are C students, if they go into a class, they always will maintain the C. But if you give them this A, they can actually hit that A. Mm-hmm. It actually works to that student's benefit. But the A students, they'll just assume that they're always going to get an A by the end, but that might not be the case, you know.
Mm.
But I want to change that bias that students have coming into a science classroom and give them and make it a positive experience instead of a negative one, right? And so if you lose a lot of points at the beginning of the semester, you still actually have an A, where it's the opposite. If you lost a lot of points at the beginning, it's hard to build that back up. And so yeah, the grading scheme is very simple and can work with any classroom. And, you know, I highly recommend it. And lots of educators that have seen me talk about this were kind of amazed by it because it's very simple, but it changes students' ability to succeed in the classroom. And students will always tell me in class, it's confusing because it's different than other classes,
mm-hmm.
but then they end up loving it because they don't have that anxiety over these numbers and grades, which I don't want them to feel that way.
Well, they walk into class, as you said, being on a high point, not a low point, as to what they have to do to crawl their way up or claw their way up, so to speak, to get that grade. They really start in a positive mindset.
That's right. It works great. And it's very simple. So
let's spend just a moment here on dyslexia and being a visual learner. How has that shaped how you relate to students, how you facilitate learning?
Well, I think for me is on my first day of class, I tell students I have dyslexia. I have a physical disability. You know, I have a genetic disease that I suffer from, chronic pain. And I think if you tell your students who you are on the first day, I think it allows them to see you in a different light, that you're actually a real person behind there and you're not this untouchable scientist. And I think students ask me, it's like, I never met a scientist who admitted in public that they were dyslexic. And I said, you know, and my parents told me, you know, that's like Einstein was dyslexic. Lots of famous scientists actually were. And you realize that, you know, it's, you know, dyslexia is a gift. I struggled with a lot of tests myself. And I tell students that, you know, I'm honest. I mean, I'm here because I had great mentors and teachers that realized I had a gift in science. And how I learn, you know, I have to do things in different ways that other faculty do, but I do it. But I think there's a lot of students out there very similar to me. And by the end of my class, when students say that, they're like, I'm dyslexic too. And I just never heard of other professors say this before. And I think sharing your story has a lot of power in the classroom. And I think people don't do it enough. But the first day of class for me is the most critical day for that reason. Because if you don't share who you are, how are those students going to relate to you or understand where you're coming from? And I think the same thing is I get to know the students on those same levels. You know, there's a personal connection there because I understand where they're struggling too. And I've been there, you know, I've been there through, you know, all of those things of lots of failures to get to lots of successes.
I'm reminded of one of your mentors who you put up in a presentation who told you that he got a D in math, but invented a microscope. And, you know, I'm just thinking of that John White quote and the power of mentorship and being transparent about who you are.
Yeah, that was, you know, John White, who actually is the person who invented the laser scanning confocal microscope that we use in our lab, turned to me one day after I failed one of my prelims in graduate school for when I was getting my PhD. And that one statement was so transformative to me. And I looked at him, I was like, seriously, you invented this microscope, but you got this bad grade? Mm-hmm. I think that was the first time in my life I heard someone that famous kind of just turn to me and say, you know, classes, you know, that class didn't matter. And I was able to do this remarkable thing. And I am in science just because of that statement. I think I was in a low point in my career. I had enough failures in the classroom and realizing maybe I don't belong in science. But he said just that one statement turned to me changed my life, course of my life forever.
UW-Madison genetics professor Anna Scope explaining her work to advance STEM, her approach to science and teaching. Are there collaborations between scientists and artists that have been meaningful to you? How so? Are you a scientist with an artistic streak? How do you explore your varied interests? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Anna Scope here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with UW-Madison genetics professor Anna Scope, who champions diversity and inclusion in STEM, uses aspects of her life story that we're hearing about to help make science more accessible, more welcoming, enlarging the tent, so to speak, in academia. Who was your role model in science? Did you know you'd be a scientist, or did someone encourage you to keep trying, keep at it when you thought you couldn't excel in math or another discipline? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Anna Scope with us for about 9 more minutes. Anna, let's talk a little bit about your passion for cell mitosis, and you call it nature painting itself. What do you see?
Well, when I first saw the process of mitosis, so from interphase, metaphase, anaphase, and then cytokinesis, is that coming from a background of artist, I was completely gobsmacked at how beautiful this process was. And then when I started to ask about it, is that there's a lot known, but there's still a lot we don't know about the process. And I think coming from a family of artists and seeing something so beautiful, and to be able then to ask the question, how does that work, right? And so I really appreciate the beauty in science. If it wasn't beautiful, probably I wouldn't study it. And partly for that reason. And I realized why later in life, why I really liked it, because my favorite artist is Moreau. And Moreau, Spanish artist, is if you look at some of his paintings, they look like cells. You can see nuclei and mitotic spindles in his paintings. And I just realized that how much art has influenced my choice in science, and partly because it's a beautiful process and very simple one.
You were very much influenced also by your late father. Could you tell us about what he did for you in art?
Well, my dad was a pupil of Mestrovic, who's a famous Croatian artist who studied with Rodin. And so my dad had an art school at our house, and he brought students from all over the world with very eclectic background growing up. My mom was a ceramicist, an art high school art teacher, and my entire family are artists. And here I am as a scientist. And I think what I realized growing up in this family, if you know anything about genetics, you might assume that I inherited the recessive gene for science. But in fact, what was actually happening there is we all inherited an immense amount of creativity. And I realized, you know, my dad had such an influence on how I think, you know, thinking outside of the box, doing something different. And I think art, having that sensitivity and knowledge about art and everything, it influences the way I do science, you know, and that's, you know, and I was welcomed into my science community because of my creativity and my background. And I think that's a great thing. And I think we need to elevate those differences in our life. And my dad was just very instrumental in being there and showing me that, you know, like Da Vinci, that was a, you know, these are scientists who are also artists back then. And I think as, you know, as time went on, the way we teach our education system, we're getting away from the fact that art is not valued in science, when in fact it really is. And in particularly in the case of communicating science, now there's this whole community of science artists online, and the need to communicate science clearly and effectively for the public, to, as people know now, is very, very important.
Let's bring on a caller now. Patricia is joining us from Madison. Hi, Patricia. What is your story? And you're on with Anna Scope.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. It's an interesting and long story. I also had dyslexia as a kid. It's called spatial dyslexia. I believe the airplane would fit in my room. I also am lefty, so when I started writing, learning how to write, I would write from right to left, like Leonardo da Vinci. So I had a lot of work. I struggled with math for years, and then when I got to ninth grade, I had this amazing teacher that was in that school for 1 year. I don't know where he came from, but the way of teaching was different. Something clicked, and now I am... I have a PhD. I got a Fulbright scholarship to come to the U.S. to do my PhD. Mm. And, I mean, you wouldn't think that when I was a kid. I struggled so much through school. Mm. And now I'm a scientist. I love science.
And what is your area of science?
I have a PhD in forestry.
Oh, wonderful. Anna, what do you hear with Patricia's story?
Well, sounds similar to me, Patricia. This is awesome to hear is that there are teachers that, you know, get you, right? Mm. And I think they inspire you to take those chances. I think that's a wonderful story, similar to mine. I said, great. I'm glad that you're able to stay in science and be excited about all that science has to offer and that you are welcome in this community. So that's wonderful to hear. And glad that you had a wonderful teacher. There's amazing teachers everywhere.
There are certainly amazing teachers everywhere. You know, I was really struck by your trajectory in being rejected as a grad student in 1994, now being in 2018 a full professor at UW-Madison. And I wonder how you reflect on that trajectory and that power of persistence.
I just think that so I was rejected from the department in which I'm a full professor. So I didn't get into the department, but I got into another department on campus. So not completely fully rejected from the UW. But I find it just ironic that sometimes I sit there on the committees understanding that at the time, the GRE, the graduate exam to get into school was there was a lot of weight put on that exam. And I'm a perfect example, someone with dyslexia, where those tests were excluding me from a lot of places. And that's how people quantify people's able to success across, you know, when you apply for a program. And I knew at that time that, you know, that there's no way that is a description of my ability in science. Fortunately for me, there were people that knew I had to have mentors talk to other mentors at schools to tell, yeah, Anna's pretty terrific in the laboratory. She's just not a good test taker. And I have test anxiety and I always had. And, the standardized tests were in no reflection of who I was as a scientist. And maybe many of you people know and listening is that a lot of schools have gotten rid of the GRE. Which is terrific because it gets rid of that. But I realize some schools are realizing they do need some of these numbers as well to assess students. But I think there's more to people than these standardized tests. And I think it's really important to look at students holistically and that when you write evaluation letters, these are really, really important for students to move through their career path. And students to understand that those letters are really important because these test scores don't evaluate you as a person and your work ability and all these kinds of things.
Anna, thank you for joining us.
Yep, thank you so much for having me.
Anna Scope, professor of genetics at UW-Madison here on the Ideas Network.